Hi, this is Meghna Chakrabarty, and you're listening to the second in an occasional series of podcast-only episodes from On Point that we're calling Remarkable Science, featuring conversations with scientists about their work, recorded in front of a virtual audience at WBUR's City Space venue in Boston. This time, how to prepare for the fall season of infectious diseases. Joining me virtually were Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, director of the Pandemic Center and professor of epidemiology at Brown University, and Dr. Albert Koh, professor of public health at the Yale School of Public Health. As we head into fall, we're still in the midst of the global COVID pandemic. Then there's the start of the annual flu season, now also monkeypox, and a resurgence of polio. So we talked about all of these diseases, and I started by asking Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo to remind us about polio, the disease, and how it got eradicated, mostly.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly frustrating to me that we have to talk about polio outbreaks occurring. Frankly, in my backyard, I actually grew up near Rockland County and deeply disappointed to hear about cases there. I knew about polio growing up because my mom was actually part of the clinical trials that resulted in the development of the vaccine. It was something she was always so incredibly proud of. And if she were alive today, I think she'd be really disappointed to hear that polio was once again circulating basically in our backyard. Polio is a disease that has been there's been a global program underway to try to eradicate it, basically to take it off the planet so that we don't have to worry about it and worry about the severe disease that it can cause in a fraction of cases. Thanks to vaccines, and there are two in use, we've made good progress in much of the world, but unfortunately, in recent years, due to slowing uptake of the vaccine or an increasing share of the population not getting fully vaccinated, we are seeing a resurgence. What we've seen with these cases is particularly related to one of the vaccines. So there are two vaccines in use. The one that's in use in the United States as an inactivated polio vaccine. But vaccines that are used in other settings, oral polio vaccine, not used here, used in other settings, in very rare circumstances, the virus that's used in those vaccines can revert to a form that can cause disease. And so it is mostly a threat for people who have not been vaccinated against polio in terms of being concerned about that severe disease. So unfortunately, what we saw in the United States was severe disease, actually paralysis, in someone who had not been vaccinated against polio. And it's really alarming because one of the features of polio is that the vast majority of the people who become infected may not have any symptoms, or they may have symptoms that are not noticeable. But in about 1 in 200 cases, paralysis can occur. And of course, this is the very serious form of the disease. So when you find a case of paralysis, you have to wonder how many infections are out there that you're not seeing. And certainly the discovery of this virus in wastewater kind of echoes those concerns.
Yeah. So now I'm reaching back into my public health hazy history here. So either of you, please correct me if I'm wrong. But so the reason why polio was and is so dangerous is because of, you know, the particular illness that it causes, right? The paralysis, it can cause paralysis in the respiratory system, right? That's why I remember those pictures of children in iron lungs. And then a high percentage of the people who actually fall sick, I think the fatality rate was like 10% or something, perhaps even higher than that. So it's a very, very serious disease. But when I just today did a quick Google News search, as anybody is wont to do, and Albert, I'm going to turn this one to you. I just want to tell you quickly what I found. I think it's important because there seems to be, as we learned with COVID, there's a gap between like internal scientific communication and what's effective public health communication, right? Because Jennifer talked about the polio vaccine, Jonas Salk, right? A Reuters news article from just a couple of days ago was like seeking to explain how it is that we're seeing polio resurgence. And there was this paragraph, and this came after two clicks from me. It said, there are two main forms of polio virus. Alongside the wild type virus that they talked about above, there was also rare cases of what's known as vaccine derived virus, right? And that's what you were talking about, Jennifer. But Dr. Koh, you know, if I'm just a person quickly reading through some news articles and I see the phrase vaccine derived virus in a good percentage of the population, that's going to set off some alarms. So can you explain a little bit more about, or pick up where Jennifer left off about why we're seeing this resurgence, if it has to do with a vaccine derived version of the virus?
Yeah, let me first off and just reemphasize what Jennifer said. I think probably one of the greatest among several public health achievements has been really the elimination of polio in many parts of the world. I'm of Korean descent. I remember going to Korea in 1969 and walking through as a little boy, you know, through the streets of Seoul and seeing all the beggars lined up and all of the people. That's all the damage caused by polio at that time. And like what Jennifer said, I grew up right across the border from Rockland County in Bergen County, you know, probably about 2 or 3 miles from where the wastewater sample was sampled. And, you know, to really have this all come back and happen after those kind of vivid images of my Boy Scout troop leader, you know, having polio, seeing cases of polio in Korea, you know, it's really, it's a tragedy. It's a public health failure. So going back to what, you know, picking up on what Jennifer was saying, so let's go through the advances and the good part of the story. So the two vaccines, and particularly the oral polio vaccine, that was a huge triumph. You know, we've saved lives around the world, saved kids from being paralyzed, the March of Dimes. And we got to the point by widespread use of that oral polio virus based vaccine, we got to the point where we pretty much eliminated, you know, cases of two of the three types of polio. And we'll call them wild types. These were the naturally occurring poliovirus. And that was poliovirus 1 and poliovirus 3. You know, as Jennifer said, you know, there is, you know, a risk, or there's a rate of these viruses, because they're transmitted, they're live and they're transmitted, they protect people, but they can go into the sanitation systems and into the water, and people can get infected with these vaccine-derived vaccine, the oral vaccine, polio vaccine. However, you know, there is a frequency, a low rate of mutations that can cause, and as Jennifer said, to go back, and they can revert to causing disease. And that's what happened first with the poliovirus, the second poliovirus 2. That virus reverted, you know, came from the vaccine, reverted to cause polio, even though it was derived from the vaccine. We've actually eliminated or pretty much eradicated the wild type virus. And now what's kind of worrisome, what happened within this last year, is that's happening now with the third poliovirus. So where we don't see wild type virus, we're seeing small little clusters. Now, obviously we need to put this all in perspective. The amount of lives saved by those oral, you know, poliovirus vaccines was much greater than, you know, what we're seeing, these clusters of cases. But if our end goal is to eradicate polio, these are worrisome signals.
Yeah. So if I understand correctly, you said there's a public health failure, but I'd like to really get a sense of what that failure is, because it sounds like what you're describing is a process of the oral vaccine is, as the body is you know, incorporating that vaccine into our immunological arsenal, some of it does end up in, you know, human waste and may go into the wastewater. And then we have that reversion or that mutation that can happen. But it seems to me that it wouldn't be a concern if you had a certain percentage of vaccinated people. That the only reason why it is the only reason why we're seeing now the number of cases from this vaccine derived polio, because we've had vaccination levels for polio drop. Jennifer, is that
exactly
the public
right.
health
That's
failure?
Yes, that's exactly right. And worldwide, this is an important trend where we're seeing an increasing increasing share of the population not availing themselves of the benefits of vaccines. And in the communities in Rockland County where this case was found and where some of the positives are, the overall vaccination coverage in those communities is actually quite low. So if you're someone who's not vaccinated and you go to a part of the world where this oral polio vaccine is being used and where there's the potential for the vaccine strain to revert to this form that's capable of causing disease, you're not protected against that severe disease. And so there is the potential that you could experience severe disease. If you're someone who's fully up to date on your vaccines, then there's very low likelihood that you would experience severe disease. So really it's a failure to avail ourselves of the benefits of vaccination. And we will continue to see cases like this as long as these viruses are circulating in communities where vaccine coverage is low. And that's why it's so important, not just to make these decisions for yourself, but also for the sake of your communities.
Right. So just to be clear, the cases that we are seeing are for people who are unvaccinated.
Correct.
For polio. Albert, I would love you to pick up on that and add more. And as well, for people watching this who've received the polio vaccine as a child, because it's part of the childhood vaccination schedule, should we be concerned as adults now? Or are there polio boosters for adults?
Okay, yeah, so just picking up from where Jennifer left off, yeah, I think, you know, we can think of this as a public health failure in different ways. And surely I think the poignant example is what's happening in under-vaccinated communities here in the United States. Let me go back to another, which I think this is, there may be some sway of what people would use as a failure, but we had the opportunity back in the 1990s and the 2000s to really make the push and to eradicate polio. You know, large investments made by countries, donor countries throughout the world, including the United States, and really not seizing that opportunity. That window of opportunity to get vaccination rates up all throughout the world, and mostly the most vulnerable populations of the world, is really, I would consider, the loss of that opportunity. That's not to negate the hard work and really the committed people from WHO, CDC, many colleagues of mine were involved in that program, really the hard work they did. But I think the unfortunate story in this tale is that we're gonna have to do a reset. Because of being unable to take that opportunity that presented itself in the 1990s, in the 2000s. Getting to your question about how long is the duration of immunity? So many of us, like myself, have had probably polio, oral polio vaccine as a child. I think I looked at my immunization card recently. I got it four times and I got IPV twice. As part of the elimination program here in the United States, the problem is that I think really to reemphasize what Jennifer is saying is that, the problem is not necessarily the duration of immunity, it's really people not getting vaccinated in the first place. We have many, children in the United States, but also in places where are at high risk for transmission, we've only gotten one or two doses, which is not enough. And what we've learned is that we need to give the inactivated polio vaccine on top of those people who got the oral polio vaccine in order to not only protect people from the disease, but to really get at the end game or the goal, which is to reduce, to block transmission or eliminate and eradicate transmission.
Okay.
So can I just add, Meg, just one please, point, please. In part because I'm most worried about people who aren't vaccinated. But I've been contacted by a lot of people recently trying to understand, well, I've been vaccinated. How worried do I have to be? Again, I'm worried about people who are not vaccinated. However, a number of people, because of these stories, are sort of going back and looking to see if they were vaccinated. And I've heard from a fair number of people who discovered to their own horror that their parents actually never got them vaccinated. Oh, wow. So if you are able to access your vaccine records, that's a good place to start. But if not, it's probably worth talking to your healthcare provider to see, just to make sure that you are in fact of the vaccine coverage that you thought you were.
Okay, so marching orders for people listening or watching right now are, if you can check your own records, do, and if not, at least definitely talk to your healthcare provider. And just to be clear, so if children are receiving the normal doses, the normal schedule, the normal vaccine schedule for polio, they should be okay, right?
We've not seen any reason to be worried about those children.
Good, because I mean, we want to put the concern in perspective as well. And it sounds like the big takeaway here is, A, we're seeing this alarming an unfortunate resurgence because of the lower vaccination rate levels. And the solution to that is be sure you're vaccinated.
And just to be clear, what these vaccines are doing is they're preventing advance this severe form of polio. That is the thing that we care about. Like I said, the majority of the people who get infected with polio have no symptoms whatsoever, but in a fraction of them, they can have this very severe disease. And so the vaccines that we use and we give children here in the United States are remarkably excellent at preventing that severe disease, which is what we care about.
Yeah. And again, I was just thinking back to all you have to let's use good information to our advantage. All you have to do is just Google some pictures from what polio looks like and the kinds of suffering that people used to go through. And you take it very seriously again.
People in my mother's generation that were just slightly older, I mean, we knew a number of them that did suffer the effects of polio here in the United States. So I might be older than some of your viewers who may not have been able to see that, to know that polio was something that that generation very much feared. And that was one of the reasons why my mom was so proud to be part of that vaccine trial, because it was a deep fear of her parents and people who grew up then, you know, the tales of parents not letting their children play or swim in places, right, because they were deeply worried that they were going to contract the disease. And the vaccine really represented a triumph over that.
Maybe I can just add one other point, and maybe, the battleground for polio is still going to be in the poorest countries and most vulnerable countries of the world. And, you know, there are two countries that, you know, until recently, you know, were the only countries that had wild type polio, the first type polio virus one, and that was Afghanistan and Pakistan. And, you know, now we're seeing the vaccine derived polios, you know, in different places. But you know, I think the bottom message is that, as Jennifer said, you know, we're going to need to get the inactivated polio vaccine here in the United States in order to protect ourselves from getting those devastating effects of polio. But the work is to save lives also and to eradicate transmission, particularly in those hotspots in the lower middle income countries. And we just can't take the foot off the gas on this, you know, make the same mistake twice again. And there is a conundrum in this, in that sense that we haven't used oral polio vaccine here in the United States until the 2000s. My children didn't get the oral polio vaccine. That vaccine was good because it not only protected you from getting disease, but it also blocked transmission. Mm. And that blocked transmission because it induced immunity in the gut, you know, the site of action where the polio virus hangs out. We haven't given that vaccine since the 2000s. There are generations, there's at least, you know, one generation of people who've never seen that oral polio vaccine. And now that inactivated vaccine doesn't generate that kind of blocking immunity, transmission blocking immunity that the oral polio vaccine had. So that is going to be a conundrum for us here, you know, again, but in putting the big picture of things, the battle is going to be in lower middle income countries where the risks, because the underlying social determinants of health are going to be greatest.
Right. No, it's an important point. And it's also one of those ironies, because if I understand correctly, that the form of vaccine that can revert, as we've been talking about, has been used in many places because you can roll it out much faster in like rapid vaccination campaigns in areas of high need as well. Is that right?
Absolutely right.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Because it's the drop, right? It's the, you know, you can give it.
Oh, right. I see.
Drop to the little baby with it.
Okay. Okay. So just one last question again, regarding marching orders for all of us who are the beneficiaries of your expertise. Should people, if they go to their physician and it's determined that they or their children should get an additional dose, what should they be asking for? Should they be asking for oral vaccine? I mean, because I think I'm getting a little confused by all the terminology. Right.
So we don't use the oral vaccine in the United States.
At all.
Right. And places that have made progress using the oral polio vaccine to diminish transmission have not needed the added benefits that the oral polio vaccine offers. And they've been able to switch to the inactivated polio vaccine, which doesn't carry the risk of, in very rare circumstances, reverting to the type that could cause disease. So there was a shift. And that's great as long as everybody gets it. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing now is, unfortunately, people choosing not to avail themselves of it. And that's why we're seeing some of these cases that we haven't seen for decades.
Okay. So there's only really one thing we can ask for, the vaccine. But
while you're talking to your healthcare provider about your vaccination status, I would add a few other diseases to the list because there's others in the news. And I think looking at your coverage for measles is important. I know certainly if you've been pregnant or if you've had a baby lately, you've probably gotten another vaccination for pertussis. And certainly people want to make sure you're up to date on your tetanus. So we don't often, I think enough, think of vaccines as adults because they're often things that we got as kids. But I think as we've learned for the past 2.5 years that there are enormous benefits and it's probably worth something just making sure we're fully up to date on.
Yeah, I actually think that's our excellent blanket order, right? Just take a look at them all and consult with your doctor, because actually you're right about adult vaccination. The only ones I've thought of recently are of course COVID, flu, and like I'm a little ways away, but shingles vaccine sometime pretty soon. That's kind of all I've thought about recently since I haven't done any international travel either. But look, we're getting some questions here, and then about polio, and then I want to move on to talk about some successes and other areas of concern as well. But someone wants to know, isn't polio vaccination required for public school enrollment? And if not, should it be? And Albert, do you want to take that one?
No, it is required for public school enrollment. And as Jennifer said, we haven't used the oral polio vaccine since 2000. And so it's the inactivated polio vaccine. It's just, you know, it's quite simple, the message for polio. What needs to be done.
Okay.
And maybe just to add, yes, it is typically required, but what we are seeing as a result of the pandemic is actually a move to sort of loosen the school entrance vaccination requirements. Mm. Some of this is around the whole unfortunate politicization of the COVID-19 vaccines and whether or not districts are, you know, have or were thinking about requiring that. That I think has led to political movement in some areas to potentially revisit the whole schedule of vaccines that are required for entry in public schools. And in my view, this is perhaps one of the most damaging consequences of the pandemic that we could see far-reaching impacts of, is if we sort of roll back progress on all of these diseases that we have been able to make thanks to the benefits of vaccination simply because of political ideologies and false understandings about what these vaccines do. So it's really important, I think, for us to guard against that and to continue to stress the importance of these vaccines and the benefits of that requirement, because at the very it offers an opportunity to make sure we're all where we need to be so that we can all protect each other.
Dr. Koh, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I think Jennifer's spot on that. Okay. And without getting into the discourse, there are loopholes, there's exemptions, you know, religious and medical exemptions. And some states, you know, the rigidity of how they follow those, you know, differs. So I think her point's an excellent one.
Yeah. What's interesting is before the pandemic, at least we had covered a couple of states that were actually trying to tighten their exemptions. Because of the dropping rate of vaccination among school children. And as you said, Jennifer, it's a bit disheartening to see things potentially going the other way. But what I want to do is take a step back here, actually, for a second. And it just seems to me that every conversation we have about public health recently has been about public health failures. But it's not all negative news all the time, because when I objectively look across all of the things that have happened since, say, March 11th, 2020, when WHO declared COVID-19 a global pandemic, I actually also see a lot of successes. And I would love for you to highlight what either of you think are one or two successes, and particularly the ones that you think that we should, you know, hold on to as part of our like permanent full-time public health and infectious disease arsenal, because we did learn a lot of lessons, and which ones should we carry forward? Albert, you take that one first.
Well, I'll take the obvious one, and that's, again, going back to, you know, the meat and potatoes, which is vaccination. We've saved, you know, 500,000 or more lives, American lives, with vaccination, and we're saving more every day because of vaccination. And I think that story has a lot of different rifts in that. You know, certainly one of them was, you know, which was enormous successes, is how quickly, you know, from the sequencing of the first genome back in, you know, 2020, you know, how vaccines we had within, you know, 9 months, you know, licensed vaccines, you know, through the emergency use authorization. We're getting out to the most vulnerable populations, the elderly, you know, underrepresented minorities, people hit hard here in the United States. So, and that saved lives. We tend to see the glass half full and, you know, looking at the vaccine hesitancy, but we got a lot of Americans vaccinated very quickly mm-hmm. in a country which never had an apparatus for mass vaccinations. I worked 30 years in Brazil, lived there for 15 years. You know, Brazil, on a turn of a dime, can vaccinate 10 million, 20 million people in a weekend. We never had that here in the United States. So I think that's a big victory we had.
Jennifer, go ahead.
Of course, vaccines. I mean, if you asked me in the beginning of the pandemic, would I think that we'd have had multiple safe and effective vaccines within a year? I mean, the answer would have been no, because that's just truly extraordinary, though. It's really, I think, a testament to what that basically prior research and investment in research pays off. But aside from that, because that's, I think, a pretty well publicized one, I think there have been a number of important advancements. One is on testing. The fact that we can now test ourselves in our homes, I think that's an extraordinary breakthrough in medicine. Obviously, there are equity issues, there are implementation issues, there are surveillance issues that stem from that. But the fact that we can test ourselves in our own home, not just for COVID, virus that causes COVID, but also flu and RSV. I mean, that's an extraordinary development. I know I had a baby that had RSV on Christmas Day and was hospitalized. To be able to have those tests at home, to know what my child had and to inform that care, that would have been really, really extraordinary. I also think we've made some important progress on telemedicine and being able to deliver care. Now, there's pros and cons, and you know whether that's the same quality of care is different, but I do think it potentially expands access, and you know we obviously have to learn more about that, but I hope that that's something that we can continue to investigate and innovate on. And then finally, you know, when I got into this field and I told people that I was an epidemiologist, almost nobody knew what that meant they weren't in the field. Now people know, which I think is extraordinary. And it's also extraordinary because it's translated to a real surge in enthusiasm for public health. Enrollments at all of our schools are off the charts. Interest in public health as a field and applications to public health schools is off the charts. So I am buoyed by that surge in interest from the next generation who, you know, are going to be on the front lines of this, that they have kind of discovered a passion around these issues because they've seen it affect their lives and the lives of their loved one, and they want to make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Meghna, could I just add one more to that list? And people can take this both ways, but now, in states that had a commitment to health equity, they achieved health equity during the COVID pandemic. I had the privilege of living in Connecticut and being part of the Connecticut response with Governor Lamont and the administration. In the first wave of COVID in March and April 2020, it was horrible pandemic, you know, horrible first wave, 11% of our nursing home residents died. But we had in our African American population, the Latino population was dying five to six times higher than our white population. But with as Jennifer mentioned, with testing, with you know public health education, with rollouts of increased access to care, and then ultimately vaccination, that has dropped. And now mortality rates, for example, between African Americans and the white population in Connecticut is not significantly different. So there could be, I think, one lesson that we really learned here that we should take forward, and not just for COVID, not for influenza, but for all our non-communicable diseases, when we're thinking about mental health, violence, you know, cancer, hypertension, is that we can do, we can, you know, we could improve social justice, or we can actually make a difference in those inequities that are inherent in our system. And I think, you know, several states in the United States, you know, Massachusetts included, where you're sitting, Meghna, you know, put proof into the principle.
Yeah. Well, that's quite an accomplishment, Dr. Koh, about what Connecticut has achieved regarding equity between groups of people in the state. So I didn't know that. Well done. You know, the other thing I would add to the list of vaccination, commitment to health equity, testing, increased awareness and interest in the importance of public health. I would also add that I think we as the public and public health experts, it was a giant exercise in relearning the importance of effective communication. And I say that because we, of course, saw examples of extremely ineffective communication and leadership and the devastating effects that can have. But then in other places, you know, in certain states, we had better communication. Other places around the world, we had leaders who were clear, not alarmist, forthright, factual, and generated trust such that people made better decisions. So I think that's a really important takeaway for all of us, both as people in the public health field, but in a sense, I suppose I'm self-reflecting here a little bit and thinking about in the modern age, not just media, but social media, any way in which information is spread, and information is totally power in trying to better the public's health. But we need to really be thoughtful about what we do, what we say, the stories that we feature, because people rely, in a sense, even though it's public health, sorry, I'm rambling here, but even though it's public health, ultimately it's only as effective as the collective individual decisions that people make, right? I think. And so being able to give people the best information to make those decisions, I think I learned was like so, so vitally important to get the collective as healthy as possible. I should end that with a question mark somehow.
I mean, public communication is one of our most important interventions. If there is a, I think that's an important recognition. I just hope it is followed with more investment in social science and behavioral science research to help us guide those communications. Right. Because I think throughout much of the pandemic, many folks, and I would probably include myself in this, were sort of winging it. But we should have more evidence-based strategies for communicating to people and to know what resonates, what doesn't, how to address people's concerns, how not to. And in an era where it's harder to get the message of truth out, we need to make sure that when we get that message out, it is as pointed and as effective as it can be.
Yeah, maybe I'll just follow up on what Jennifer said. You know, we had remarkable achievements, I think, in terms of science, certainly development of vaccines, the rollout of tests, the development and evaluation of diagnostic tests, you know, therapeutics, you know, clinical trials that showed steroids saved lives early on. I think if there's something that, say, I'm going to, you know, turn it around and say that maybe the glass half full on this one is the communication. We found ourselves many times, you know, and this is from experience with the state of Connecticut, where we had no evidence base. You know, mm-hmm. What's the best way to get the vaccines or to address vaccine hesitancy, or how do we get people better access? You know, and what are the communication strategies for that? And so I think, you know, Jennifer, and this is a lot of her scholarship and her work, but, you know, I think we need more of that next time around.
Well, so we've mentioned vaccines and the COVID vaccine in particular a couple of times. We have this question from the audience. Has mRNA technology changed the outlook for infectious diseases?
So I remain optimistic, but maybe my optimism is slightly tempered than it was maybe about a year ago. And I say that because mRNA technology, vaccine technology, I think is poised to potentially make a number of important contributions to prevent disease, but also to treat potentially other illnesses. So I think our use of the vaccine, you know, perhaps has broken the seal to more fully explore the benefits that mRNA technology can offer. So extraordinarily enthused by that medical breakthrough. Where my optimism is slightly tempered is that one of the benefits of mRNA technology for vaccines is the potential ability to rapidly update them. But unfortunately, as we've seen play out throughout COVID, the kind of, I don't know, I'll just say the processes for actually updating vaccines and getting new vaccines that are probably best matched to the viruses that are out there turn out to not be as fast a pivot as we would perhaps like. And so those are potentially tractable problems. And in my view, much easier to solve than getting the next medical breakthrough. But I think many people, including myself, have been disappointed that we haven't sooner and more quickly availed ourselves of this benefit of mRNA technology, which is the ability to more rapidly update the vaccines as needed.
Yeah, let me throw out one, I think, way that it may potentially revolutionize how we deal with emerging infections or emerging infectious diseases. So if we go back, you know, to pre-COVID, you know, this is after Zika, you know, there was a large emphasis or a large initiative, international initiative. This was the WHO Research and Development Blueprint, as well as CEPI, the Commission for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. And these two, they were searching, and they had a list of priority diseases. Coronaviruses were on one of them, but literally there was a disease X. And the idea here in disease X and the searching before COVID was what was going to be the platform that was going to be plug and play. So if it's COVID one day or if it's an influenza virus the other, how could you manufacture and get it approved and disseminated to everybody? There were other platforms that were used, much more labor intensive, costly, and less efficient. And I think, one of the advantages I think that we learned from the COVID is that this mRNA is a good platform or potentially good platform as we encounter new emerging infections and the new disease X's in the future.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of both sort of scientific and political complexities to this and how frequently the new formulations can be made. Because, I mean, for example, just right now, or recently, the FDA approved the reformulated Pfizer booster for the BA.5 subvariant, COVID subvariant, I believe. And again, if I'm reading the reporting around it correctly, this particular reformulation has only been tested on mice. And so I think there's already evidence of concern out there amongst some people. I mean, if we're talking about vaccine hesitancy, is that a misunderstanding about the effectiveness or safety of the booster? Or, I mean, should even reformulations for updated variants still also go through all the stages of trial, including safety trials for human clinical trials? Jennifer, I'll toss that one to you.
Yeah, so it's true that the data that were submitted to get the authorization of the reformulated boosters were not from human, they weren't human data. Those data are being collected and they will come, but they weren't used in the decision making around the authorization of these boosters. Recognize that we now have extraordinarily rich amount of data regarding the safety and efficacy of boosters. And what you're just seeing here is a swap of the virus type, or the target used to create these new boosters, for which there's precedent to think of making swaps like that. And actually, it's one of the kind of visions for how we will get better at making vaccines in future public health emergencies, that perhaps we can do some of the preliminary research before on classes of viruses that we might worry about. Coronaviruses were on our list of things we worried about before 2020. But could we have done the research in advance to evaluate certain vaccines based on the viruses that we knew, and then if something emerged, perhaps swap it out for what the actual virus is, and to try to, you know, expedite the authorization of that, such that we don't unnecessarily risk losing lives when we have sound data suggesting the safety and efficacy of those vaccines for near relatives. I think it's I think a concern that's understandable given the headlines, but it's not one that I particularly worry about. And I haven't yet gotten the new booster, and maybe we can have a conversation about timing of when to get it, but it's not something that I'm worried about in terms of getting vaccinated.
Well, so let me put a little refinement on here, right? Because I wish we could only talk, I wish that the our area of focus could be exclusively this, you know, science, but it's not, right? It's science, it's politics, it's implementation, it's public perception. I mean, that is public health, right, writ large. And, you know, I do wonder if the human data is being collected now. I mean, should the FDA have waited a little bit before authorizing this booster, so that there's no room for misinterpretation of its effectiveness or safety once people hear, like, oh, it's thus far only been tested on mice. Albert, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm thinking along the ways exactly as Jennifer is. There are certain phrases that came out during the pandemic, evidence-based. You know, we had evidence-based before that, but, you know, lead by the science. That doesn't necessarily mean that the risks, there's 100% benefits and 0% risk, okay? And we know that when we take any cardiac medication, or when we go under a open bypass, you know, surgery, there are risks, you know, involved. But weighing this, and to me, and just to put what, we have vaccines where we don't test them in humans, but we use them. Influenza vaccine is a good one, you know, is a good example. We have what we call as correlates of protection. We know that this vaccine, with all the experience we've had, you know, what makes a vaccine work by based on the immune response that it generates. We are entering in that, you know, situation. We have a lot of experience, hundreds of millions of people have been vaccinated with the mRNA vaccines. We know how they work, you know, to some degree. We may not, you know, this is where the situation where perfection becomes the enemy of the good. Mm. And what we really are, many of us are worried about, is what's going to happen this winter. You know, we're relaxing social distancing, face masking. Our barrier or our wall for against a large COVID surge is going to be vaccination and increasing, you know, immunity around the population. If we waited for perfect data, we wouldn't have this vaccine probably for another 6 months. Mm. From now, and we'll lose that window of opportunity to protect our children, to protect our communities, people living in multi-generational, homes, to protect, protect everyone. And let me just go back to kind of a practical one as an infectious disease physician. Our hospitals before COVID went into surge crisis every influenza season. And Meghna, you raised this, and Jennifer raised this. We've had crises before COVID. And if we have a large COVID wave on top of a bad influenza wave, you know, that's, we already have a weakened, demoralized healthcare workforce. And we need to protect them. And so from a societal benefit, this makes, you know, to me, I'm just reiterating, re-emphasizing what Jennifer says, it makes perfect sense that we don't lose this window of opportunity to protect our communities and populations and our healthcare systems. Mm.
Well, if you don't mind, I want to shift gears slightly. This is always one of the bittersweet aspects of these conversations. Like, any one thing that either of you say, I could think of like, let's talk about for the whole hour about that one particular thing, but alas, we can't. And I want to shift to something that sort of links what's happening in the present with then future preparedness. And it has to do with monkeypox. And a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Dr. Ali Khan, who's Dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And he was also formerly at CDC as a director of the Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response. And you both know him well and his career. He's a globe-trotting, emerging infectious diseases specialist, really remarkable person. So we talked about the monkeypox outbreak. And in the middle of the conversation, he dropped something on me that literally has been jaw-dropping for me. He suggested, and we're about to hear it, he suggested that our response on monkeypox should be actually serving as a warning.
This was a smallpox dress rehearsal, wasn't it, in many ways? So, no, it's clearly we've defined it's inadequate. I mean, the good news is that we do have sufficient vaccine for a smallpox pandemic, if it was truly smallpox. But if this was a dress rehearsal, it's not looking well. And it shouldn't surprise us. I mean, given what we saw with COVID, given what we've just seen with monkeypox, to do better, we need to dramatically transform the public health system as it currently exists.
So that's Dr. Ali Khan. And when he said that a response currently to monkeypox was a smallpox dress rehearsal, I asked him what he meant by that. And, you know, he said in part, it's like sort of the rollout and the availability of monkeypox vaccine, because it's like the same, right, as for a smallpox vaccine. And that he was concerned that if for something that we already have a vaccine for, there wasn't like a waiting period to create a new one for this, that we weren't able to get it out into communities as quickly as possible, that it should raise alarm bells. And Jennifer, I just wonder what you thought about that.
So he's absolutely right. It should raise alarm bells. It's a dress rehearsal period, not just for smallpox. I have to stress for people who may not know, smallpox is the one human disease that has been eradicated. I was very fortunate to work for 13 years with the man who led the global smallpox eradication program. And it is a remarkable achievement that we wiped it off the planet, except for existence in two known laboratories. So when he's saying a dress rehearsal for smallpox, were smallpox cases to occur, it would be likely not under natural circumstances. It
was deliberate
outbreak. So I just have to clarify that, so people aren't just adding smallpox to their 2022 bingo card of, you know, the next natural outbreak that they're going to have to
forget
about.
Before you go on, I just wanted to add to that, just to underscore what you said, because what Dr. Khan followed up by is he's saying like we would only see smallpox again if it was like a bioterrorism attack or some kind of catastrophic lab failure, because it only exists in very, 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 very controlled circumstances and in only a few places in the world. So I don't want people, like you're right, I don't want people to go out thinking, oh my God, we're on the tip of the iceberg for smallpox. That's not true.
And because of that, there are different sets of plans, because it would be a very much a security situation. But that said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't take an attack to see how ill-prepared we are. Monkeypox is a dress rehearsal for, you know, many future and emerging infectious disease threats. It was one that we should have gotten right, because it was probably one of the easier scenarios. We had a diagnostic that was already deployed to laboratories that throughout the country. We had a vaccine. We had in development therapeutic candidates to use to help treat people. So we had a number of tools from day one that should have allowed us to very swiftly contain this virus and put it back in the box. Unfortunately, there were several very, very, in my view, maddening missteps along the way that make me deeply worried about our preparedness as a country. And, you know, I think it points to many key lessons that we need to address urgently. And in the beginning of COVID, there were many missteps. Some of it you could sort of give a, I won't say a pass to, but sort of understand, because COVID was a new virus. We hadn't really experienced something in a long time, but monkeypox coming on the heels of COVID when the system's been activated, where we've been supposedly, you know, improving our preparedness all along the way, to have this unfold in the way that it's been unfolding, and possibly risk now seeing yet another virus become something to contend with in this country for the time being is deeply it's maddening.
Albert, I'm going to come to you in just one second, but since you were so emphatic about a number of maddening missteps, can you specify at least what one or two of those were, so again we can learn and not repeat those?
So for me, one of the first maddening missteps is that it became clear relatively early that the way that we were testing for the virus wasn't working. I'm not a clinician, Albert is, but when I heard from my clinician colleagues who were deeply motivated and deeply educated about this, that it was way too hard to get their patients tested, that should have sounded alarm bells that the way that we were going about trying to find cases wasn't working, and that we needed to expand testing to include private laboratories. That took 2 months to make happen, and that shouldn't have been the case. We should have also had a crash course on other diagnostic tools, potentially looking at other specimen types, like maybe saliva or other things, to see if we can make it easier to diagnose patients, some research and development. We didn't get the communication right, and we're still not getting the communication right. There is, of course, worried about how to talk about the epidemiology of the monkeypox we're seeing in a way that's not stigmatizing to the affected communities. I'm not going to say that it is an easy thing to communicate, but this is a lesson that we should take forward every single time we have an outbreak of a new infectious disease or an unusual infectious disease. Stigma will be something that we have to actively guard against. And the fact that we don't have ready, robust plans to combat stigma while also talk fairly to the data that we see is another preparedness misstep. Then, of course, we didn't have enough vaccines, and it took a while, and there are a lot of government missteps about how long it took to get vaccines. So a lot of things that I really hope we just open the books on and have an autopsy or a forensic dive into what went wrong so that we can finally fix these problems so we don't just keep seeing them repeating themselves over and over again.
Albert, go ahead.
Okay, so yeah, no, I think Jennifer really did a very good semi-forensic dive into that. And just to reemphasize, we need that forensic dive. We need to do it for COVID. We haven't really done it for COVID. And I think the other thing she said was really kind of resonates, which is the stigma. We've gone through the AIDS, myself taking care of patients with AIDS, and we just haven't gotten right. And I would put the blame on ourselves and how, the lack of scientific evidence, in that we really, the social behavioral sciences and getting the communication right, and we shouldn't have been in this situation. Let me also take a different tact. So monkeypox was probably circulating probably for several years in the poorest countries of the world. I kind of go back to this point, but many of these diseases, they are diseases of vulnerable populations. Mm-hmm. And this was, circulating in countries which had maybe weakened surveillance systems, certainly during the pandemic, resource poor infrastructures. And the one thing that's really frustrating for many of us who work in global health is that we're just, making the same errors over and over. This is a structural problem. We saw this with COVID. We saw this with Zika. We saw this with Ebola. There are structural problems. We live in a highly globalized world where, because of travel, because of urbanization and so forth, we're going to have drivers pushing the spread of these pandemics. And we just haven't gotten it right because we don't have the right international structural bodies that are strengthened and appropriately strengthened and empowered to respond to this. So, of course, there are issues here in the United States. Those issues have been replicated in many other countries. But we need to get it right at the international level. And until the US and many other countries step up and do that, we're going to be in the same situation. We're going to be always the dog, trying to bite its tail.
Yeah. Well, we're sort of rounding to the last part of this conversation tonight. And over my many years of reporting and being a member of Homo sapien and watching how public health works, I always thought that one of the ironies of the work that you all do is that when public health is working really well, it's, to most of us, it's essentially invisible, right? And that our attention is only focused on the need for good public health practice, good public health infrastructure, funding, all the things we've talked about today, when there's an emergency. And so I call that an irony because we don't want to have those emergencies. And I wonder if there's, what do you think it would take to sort of permanently pull the importance of public health out of that sort of invisible shadow during the good times? Because those are also the times the funding goes down, right? Because people think, well, why do we have to fund it? Things are working, right? Such that it's more part of just what we as a society think is necessary for the overall well-being of our people, our nation, you know, for the planet, but out of just sheer self-interest, like, how do we make it part of how we conceive of as what is needed for the well-being of the United States as a country? Jennifer, you go ahead.
So it's true. I mean, we kind of, I won't say joke, but, you know, sort of lament that in public health, our job is to make sure nothing happens, you know, to prevent the thing from happening. And it's hard to see what didn't happen. And so I think that's a general sort of conundrum of the field. But I also think we shouldn't limit ourselves with that view, because I do think it's absolutely critical going forward that public health not be so invisible, or be more visible, I will say, and to be in people's lives more and to show the work that we do. I think that's absolutely critical. And the theme of this conversation was one new disease after another. This will keep happening. All of the data that we have suggests that the frequency of newly emerging disease outbreaks is increasing. They don't all become pandemics, but they could. And so we have to get better. The system has to get better. And we as a society have to get better prepared. You know, we do a lot to prepare for other recurring hazards in our lives. We have fire drills, you know, we think about weather events, you know, tornado watches, all sorts of things. And we need to build that culture of safety around infectious diseases that we have for other hazards in our lives. And, you know, I think some places in the world are better at doing this than others. You know, one of the things I got the privilege of studying in my career was I got to go to Taiwan to observe that prior to COVID, after the first SARS, prior to COVID, Taiwan would schedule every year an exercise to administer flu vaccines en masse. And they did that in part because they wanted to make sure that people who were most susceptible to severe illness from flu got their flu vaccine and that they had a dedicated opportunity to do that. But they also did it to practice for the emergency, the pandemic that they thought could happen, so that when there was an emergency, people would know where to go and what to do, and that they could test their systems regularly. And I think we have to do more exercises like that, and to do that involving communities so that people feel part of the system, so that the first time they see public health isn't an emergency, and that public health, this entity that they don't know what it is, just showing up in their lives sort of unannounced and asking them to do things that they're not quite sure they should do. I think we have to engage with the community and have their values inform the plans that we develop. And that's, you know, I think a lot of the political tensions that we've seen over COVID was perhaps because we failed to be able to do that in advance. Going forward, we shouldn't. We should engage with communities and understand their values and have those values shape our response. Because one of my favorite quotes is from former Senator Sam Nunn, who in an exercise in which he played the President of the United States responding to infectious disease emergency, remarked that, like, no force of the US government, or no force of government, no matter how powerful, can compel 300 million Americans to do something that they don't see is in their best interest. So engaging with the public and having their partnership in the work that we do is absolutely critical for our preparedness. So I do hope that if we do more of that, that public health isn't something that people have never heard of, that one day they go back to forgetting existed.
Albert, you're gonna get the last word tonight.
Okay, well, let me just say, I think what you're describing, Meghna, is that it's one of the several public health paradoxes. And there's a psychological, psychosocial, you know, part in. You know, obviously, when you're feeling well, you have less incentive to do prevention than if you're sick, you know, to then seeking treatment. And we see this in many senses, you know, not only in terms of adherence to care, you know, prevention versus treatment, but also in terms of reimbursement, economic reimbursement. And when you said invisible, what, you know, it's invisible and underfunded.
Yeah.
So these are structural issues. This problem that we've had in our public health system, you know, CDC, local public health, they've been crying. This is not something that happened overnight. It wasn't one administration. This is 20 or 30 years of underfunding that happened. And that, I'm going to go out on a limb for the last point. I think there's a second aspect to it. Those, if you look at those countries that did well, those are countries that invested in social rights, that invested in legal, had a legal infrastructure for social rights. And many of those countries had universal healthcare. And we just, you know, as long as we're fighting that battle of not protecting our communities and populations and their social rights, we're always going to be behind the game. So I'm thinking of this as a structural issue, all solvable, but it would require, you know, massive, you know, restructuring. This is Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, Korea. They did this after the SARS. You know, they had probably one of the, I wouldn't say the worst, but they didn't have really great public health systems before SARS and MERS, but they turned it around. And we just haven't been able to get that right. And those are structural issues that I would highlight.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And what's now needed is the political will to address those structural issues, because we can solve them. It's not that we have to create brand new solutions out of whole cloth. We actually know what works as well. This has been a truly tremendous conversation. I could have listened to both of you for quite a while longer, but Dr. Albert Ko, the Raj and Indra Nui Professor of Public Health at the Yale School of Public Health, thank you so much for your time and your expertise tonight.
Thank you very much, Magna.
And Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, Director of the Pandemic Center and Professor of Epidemiology at Brown University. Dr. Nuzzo, thank you so much too. It was just awesome to see you and to hear you once again.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
That was Remarkable Science, How to Prepare for the Fall Season of Infectious Diseases, held at WBUR's City Space earlier this month in a virtual conversation. Thank you so much for listening. And by the way, subscribe to the On Point podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker to play the On Point podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.